Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel was seen as a hero after the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. Now he's under attack for not doing enough to stop it. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are calls from dozens of lawmakers in Tallahassee for Sheriff Israel to step down or be suspended. The NRA has attacked him over reports that deputies remained outside the school even while students were shot. We'll look at the controversy surrounding the sheriff. And we'll talk to a director of a national organization of school resource officers about how far school police are expected to go to protect their campus. Also, Stoneman Douglas students are preparing to return to school this week. What is the school district doing to help them get back to a daily routine? We'll hear from a student and from our reporter who attended yesterday's orientation. All of that coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High students will be back in their classes on Wednesday of this week. Many of them, along with their parents, were on campus this weekend for a special orientation. The school called it a reunification. One of the parents in attendance was Doug Mox.
You know, you're trying to go to school Wednesday morning and the shock of being back on campus. So it was a great idea. Other than the freshman building, I mean, it's like it always is.
WLRN's Katie Swatalski was there, and she joins us now to tell us a little bit about what that reunification was like and what parents and students are talking about. Katie, describe the scene for us yesterday. What looks different around the school?
Hi, Lewis. So a lot looks the same, but there is a lot that is different. There's flowers everywhere, big banners and posters from other schools and other communities in Broward County, just reminding Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, we love you, stay strong. There's lots of rainbows, and the fences are very decorated with memories of the victims who died in the shooting. But other than that, parents and students told me it looks the same, but it feels different.
Did most students take part in the orientation, as far as you could tell?
As far as I could tell, there were hundreds and hundreds of families coming in and out. You know, I don't want to say thousands, but it was very, very busy yesterday.
Did they return to the freshman building where most of the shootings occurred, you know, to maybe pick up their belongings?
No, no one was allowed inside that building. It's not open. It's still under investigation. And as far as I can tell, no students will ever go back inside. Classes have been moved to other buildings on the campus, and it's just not open to them.
So tell me about how the students and the parents were handling everything, I mean, emotionally, as they're walking back on campus. They hadn't been there since the shooting and everybody was evacuated.
Yeah, that's right. It's really tough. You have these parents that are super nervous for their own reasons, but overwhelmingly they told me they were much more nervous for their children. You know, they were the ones who were there. They're the ones who are now dealing with some PTSD symptoms, and their children are afraid. So, you know, parents had their own safety concerns, but they did feel better. You know, I had a couple moms tell me they felt better going back with their kids to gauge how their kids were feeling the whole time, and make sure that they got themselves refamiliarized with what used to be familiar.
I wondered if you'd talk to any of the parents or kids, because I'm curious about how kids are supposed to get back to any sort of normalcy, get back to taking tests, doing homework, especially when you're on a campus and, you know, not that long ago, this horrific thing happened there.
Exactly. And I wondered the same thing. And I talked to several students yesterday who said, you know, they don't want to go back. And that's okay. I think parents and teachers realize that. There will be counselors there throughout the week. And, you know, kids are, they're very weary. And so parents are like, look, the number one thing here is they've got to get back to school and try to get this normalcy. But at the same time, it's okay if they're not reading books for a while and they're talking with their teachers about what happened and how to handle it instead of taking pop quizzes or, you know, doing math problems. So that might take a while to get back to full-fledged normalcy.
Did you get to talk to any teachers?
I did not. I had parents and students tell me that teachers were inside in classrooms ready to talk to students and parents and be there for them inside the school. So you know, they got to go back on Friday, and Wednesday is only a half day. Their first full day back will be Thursday.
And the principal was there for the for this orientation, and basically was hugging everybody.
Yes, he was. He stayed true to his social media promise to hug every single student, and he was there inside. I'm told he hugged every single one of them.
There were students, as you said, who said they were not ready to return. So how is the school supposed to deal with that? I mean, do you have to force a kid back to school? Or in a situation like this, does the school just say, okay, come back when you're ready?
Well, they are starting attendance Wednesday, but it seems to be up to parents and teachers and students to gauge, okay, this one needs a day off, okay. You know, parents have really got to gauge their own kids here and say, you need to go back and try, or, you know, it's okay to stay home one or two more days. I mean, there were a lot of tears yesterday, lots of long hugs. There's just so many different emotions.
And how is everyone reacting to this huge wave of activism that some of the Douglas students have started? I mean, do most students and teachers seem as engaged, or is it just that group of students that we keep seeing on television?
Everyone I spoke to yesterday was very engaged. The parents I talked to were just, you know, if one could beam with pride in a situation like this, it would be for how the kids have acted. So all the parents I spoke with were like, anything we could do to help these kids, we'll do it to support them. So people were very engaged and willing to participate and just proud of being so courageous in an outcome that has been such a tough situation. And as far as I can tell, teachers and the administration really support these kids. If they want to be active, their school is behind them.
Now, we've seen and we reported on a number of schools here in South Florida where students walked out. They walked out of class, walked down the street, walked out to a football field. They left class, you know, in solidarity with everything that's been going on. But students here at Douglas, does the administration support any more walkouts or any other acts, perhaps, say, of protest? Or, again, if they're, you know, just wanting to make a statement, are they okay with that?
Well, that's a good question. I think the school is definitely okay with supporting this kid's activism and, you know, supporting their message. I have not heard anything about walkouts or whether or not the administration would be okay with walkouts at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. But I did see a lot of students there yesterday at this reorientation that were not actually Marjory Stoneman Douglas students. They were students from West Boca High, and they were, you know, saying they came to get a better sense of, you know, their own fear in this situation and show more of that solidarity.
Now, we had played a cut from one of the fathers, Doug Mox, who was there. Here's something else that he was talking about with getting the kids back to school.
It's good for the kids to get back here and get amongst their friends and their peers and kind of function again instead of sitting at home watching CNN.
I was wondering, too, with some of the parents and students that you had talked to, if they hadn't been involved in all the activism, what have they been doing during all of this time?
I'm glad you asked that, because I wondered the same thing. And I talked to, I mean, the theme of the entire almost 2 weeks now that I've been in Parkland talking to kids and their parents and teachers is they just want to be together. So kids are, you know, they're really not leaving their group of friends, whether they're doing nothing or they're trying to play basketball or they're just sitting at each other's houses. They really don't want to leave their classmates, so they're staying in big groups as much as possible.
Again, we've been talking with WLRN's Katie Swatalski, talking about this reunification, again, this sort of orientation that they had over the weekend at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, where parents and students came back to, well, get ready to come back to school. And again, classes will start on Wednesday. It's a half day, though, on Wednesday. Katie, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, coming up, we're going to talk to one of those students about what they expect when they go back to school this week. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, during the past week and a half, we have seen and heard from Stoneman Douglas students. They've been on national television, on radio shows. A group of them went to Tallahassee to talk with lawmakers about gun laws. And as we've just heard, they'll be back in school this week. Well, we're joined now by Diego Pfeiffer, a senior at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Diego, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you, and thank you for hearing our voices. The media is what's really propelling our message and propelling everything that we want done in the world out there. So thank you for listening.
Did you go to the orientation this weekend?
I unfortunately was not able to attend the orientation. I had a big Telemundo call at 5, but my sister did go, and I had a lot of friends who I texted and made sure that they were okay. And I had a couple of teachers that wanted to plan, like, hey, come in at 4 at my room. And I did hear a lot about it. I heard there were service ponies, so a little sad to miss out on that one. But
yeah. Well, the classes are going to start back up on Wednesday. And, I mean, are you ready to get back to school?
I mean, it hits me in waves. Like, I definitely, one time when somebody told me that it would really hit when I saw an empty desk in one of my classrooms, like, I definitely had to sit down. I was about to faint. But right now, I'm feeling pretty confident. I'm prideful that all of my students and all of my teachers are so strong going through this and remembering those that we've lost. And I really want to be there to support them. So I will be going back. I'm not going to say that I'm not going to be scared, because that would probably be lying, but I am definitely going back, because the fear that we all fear is not going to, it's not going to triumph our spirit.
Have you heard about any student who said they're just not ready yet?
Of course. What's up with me is that I'm a senior, so I've had 3 years of great experiences and then 2 hours of a horrible experience. Now I can imagine the freshmen who haven't even grown close to the school, the student body, or some of the teachers yet, I'm sure it's much, much harder for them. And my thoughts and prayers go out to them. And I'm sure that my school is taking action as well to try to reintegrate those people. I know a bunch of different students have a bunch of different plans, and I'm happy to hear every single one of them.
Now, you were one of the students who went up to Tallahassee to meet lawmakers last week, correct?
I absolutely was.
Do you get the sense, did you feel that lawmakers were listening to you?
Well, I had a much, much better experience than some of my peers, because some of my peers, like the lawmakers, didn't even show up to said meetings, which was very disappointing. But for me, halfway through, it felt a little more, instead of just talking to them, it felt like we were actually conversing. We were actually coming up with some good ideas. I had a senator ask us to stop talking for a second and say, I know that some people see this as a sign of disrespect, but can I please take notes?
Okay, interesting. You also met with Governor Scott.
Yes, I did.
What did he tell you?
So Governor Scott most definitely tried to steer the conversation towards school safety and what we could do to feel safe at school. I know a lot of different groups didn't have the best experience with him. They tried to take like an emotional standpoint. I heard one group even tried to play some of the clips of the shooting, which was a little too far for my taste. But my team, my little group of students that I was with, we were very factual. We were very to the point, and we always steered the conversation right back to gun laws and what we can do, gun safety, all that sort of stuff. Governor Scott seemed, I don't know, he seemed, like, I saw him taking a couple notes as well. He seemed reactive to what we were saying, especially when we completely shot down some of his ideas. Do you want metal detectors? No, that's not going to work.
And he just unveiled his legislative changes related to guns and school safety. What do you think of his proposals?
I think it's a step in the right direction, of course. And I think that we, like, any steps that are going to help us feel safer and help such tragedies from not happening again, they're all good places to start. But start is the key word in that sentence. One step is not an entire journey. And we obviously want more from our legislatures, more from everybody right now. He's given us the bare minimum.
What do you think about what lawmakers are doing right now, though, in Tallahassee? Look, they've got a couple of weeks left before the session ends. But how do you feel about how they're approaching this? And there was also the fact that once you guys got up there, they actually had shot down a discussion about assault rifles.
Yes, well, they explained that while we were up there, and that was a big political stunt. That was not planned in any of the books. They just kind of blew that up there. And the House of Representatives, those people explained to us as well that said assault rifles would not have even included the AR-15, which is currently classified as a long rifle. So there were multiple reasons to shoot down that bill. There was specific information on that bill so that it would be shot down. And that bill was only placed to dampen our spirits. Now, it did not dampen our spirits, obviously, and we continue to fight. We continue to change. And I feel that some of the people that I talked to were very reactive to what we had to say. They heard some of them heard our voices, and those that refuse to hear our voices will hear it from somewhere else, whether it be news or their own peers that decided to take a stand with us. And I'm excited to see what they're going to come up with.
All right, so that's on the state level. Let's take a look quickly on the national level. And we've heard from the president of the United States, who has gone on Twitter and who's gone on to say that perhaps the best thing is to arm the teachers. What do you think about that?
All right, so we heard about this Marshall Plan up in Tallahassee with all the students. And when asked about it, when Governor Rick Scott asked the students, who is a fan of arming the teachers? Nobody raised their hand. Nobody enjoys that idea. I've talked to teachers who say, wait, I'm supposed to act as a teacher and as law enforcement? And then you look at the big problems with all of our law enforcement not jumping in. If our trained law officials were not able to jump in and apprehend a shooter, what makes you think a teacher would? There's so much stuff that shoots down the idea of the good guy with the gun. And honestly, it's just the NRA's way of selling two guns, not one.
Again, I'm talking with Diego Pfeiffer. He's a senior at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. The students are going to be returning to class on Wednesday. Wednesday is a half day, but this now 2 weeks after the shooting on the campus. You know what, Diego, why do you think that you and your friends have been able to turn this experience, this terrible experience, into this very loud activism?
Well, I would just come out and say it, that whenever I was asked where I live, I say, oh, I live near Coral Springs, Boca area. Nobody knows where Parkland was before this happened. And we don't want Parkland to be on the maps because a mass shooting occurred there. So we knew we needed something big to change everyone's perception of Parkland. We're not just a place where people died. We're a place where people died and somebody decided to do something about it.
Mass shootings have become a regular occurrence, on school campuses and other places, obviously, within the last couple of years. You know, we had the Las Vegas shooting not that long ago, the Pulse shooting, and again, we've had other mass shootings in schools. I'm curious, though, when those happened, how did you react, and why is this seem so different? Because I haven't seen students speak up the way you guys have.
Well, beforehand, you would see the news, and you would feel sorry for the parents, and you would maybe give funds to, like, help the victims' funds, or something like that, but the media would leave after a couple of days and it would eventually be forgotten. We have captured the nation's attention. We've captured the media's attention. People want to hear more about this, mainly because they want to believe that this will be the last one, that these students are actually going to make a said difference. The difference is that we are the right age, and honestly, this couldn't happen anywhere but Parkland. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas is a public school with a private school education. All of the kids here are so, so smart. All the teachers are great. And it was the wrong place at the wrong time, but the right people.
You know, thinking back now, it's easy to look back and make judgments. But, you know, we're looking back at as much as we can about this shooter. And obviously all of these red flags pop up, and the question comes up, well, why didn't we spot this before? Knowing what we know now, though, do you look at certain people differently?
Well, I will tell you that about a week before the shooting, my little sister told my father and I, you know what, if there's going to be a school shooting, I think it's going to be this week. She predicted it, but she predicted it with the wrong person. And that strikes tons of fear in my heart, because that person that she was scared of was going to shoot up the school, he's still out there. And I don't know if he's mourning right now. I'm sure he is, because everybody was affected by this tragedy. But there were people, and there was a list that a couple of people compiled and gave to FBI officers and gave to the police of possible copycats and such. So, of course, this changes our perception of everyone. It heightens our fear, but that heightened fear also makes us seek personal bonds. It heightens friendship. Honestly, I don't think I could have gone through this process the way I did if it wasn't for all my friends that were always with me, that were always talking. We mourn together here, and that's just as strong as being scared together.
Diego, can you keep up this pace of activism, considering, again, you got to go back to school, you got classes, all the other activities, and you're a senior, so you're already getting ready, thinking about college.
Yep. The activism. Well, we've got plans. I will tell you that. We've got tons and tons of plans. Right now, the biggest one is March 24th, the March for Our Lives. We might diminish a little bit while we're going back to school and we're settling everything, but like a week, 2 weeks before March for Our Lives, you are going to be hearing from us. It is going to be a big boom. The media is going to cover everything, and we are going to make a stand. That is when we take our message to Washington. That's where we knock on their doors and plead for our children's lives. I believe that because of the plans that we're making, that just because we're not going to have as much time doesn't mean that we're not going to have as much difference in our world.
Diego Pfeiffer, again, he is a senior at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. He was there a couple of weeks ago when the shooting occurred. Diego, I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right. And good luck to you as you return to classes this week.
Thank you.
All right. Still to come, the Broward Sheriff went from being a hero to a scapegoat. We're going to find out what's going on. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, besides the students, Broward Sheriff Scott Israel has become the face of the aftermath of the shooting, but now he's under attack for the way his deputies handled it. It's been reported that a number of them remained outside of the campus as the shooting continued. Dozens of lawmakers are calling for Governor Scott to suspend Israel. The sheriff says he's not stepping down. Well, joining us now is David Smiley, reporter with the Miami Herald, covering this story. David, great to have you back, man. David, are you there?
Hey, can you hear me, Lewis?
Yeah, there you are. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. You know what, David? There are quite a few state legislators calling on Governor Rick Scott to either suspend or remove Sheriff Israel. What is the governor likely to do?
Well, he has asked the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to conduct its own inquiry into the sheriff's office response and really all local police response to the shooting. The FDLE's commissioner has said that they have already begun that effort. So likely Governor Rick Scott has said he will wait until those findings come out before making any sort of decision on, you know, if and whether he would consider suspending Scott Israel. It's sort of a politically convenient effort for the House of Representatives to undertake. It's a Democratic sheriff in the most heavily Democratic county in the entire state. The House Speaker is probably running for governor. It might even be convenient for Governor Scott to remove him because he would be able to replace Israel if he's suspended with his own appointee. Crist did that about 10 years ago, put in Republican Al Lamberti. Maybe a Republican sheriff helps him campaign, but it doesn't seem that Scott's in any rush to do that.
How many lawmakers have turned on Sheriff Israel?
I want to say, off the top of my head, I think it was 73. It was basically almost all of the Republicans in the House. I don't think George Moraitis, who is a Broward County representative, a Republican, I don't believe he signed it.
All right, so bring us up to date on what we know about deputies remaining outside of the school during the shooting.
So yesterday on CNN, the sheriff gave some more information. He did confirm that three, four, maybe five Broward Sheriff's deputies were outside the school or the 1200 building where the shooting had taken place when a number of Coral Springs police arrived. So that's been reported, and Israel confirmed that yesterday. But he said that part of what BSO is looking into is why they were outside. He indicated that the school resource officer, Deputy Scott Peterson, who resigned rather than likely be fired last week for allegedly failing to go inside the school. The sheriff said that Scott Peterson may have put out some kind of communication about trying to establish a perimeter that the shooter may have been leaving. It's kind of unclear exactly what Israel was referring to. He says that they are still trying to cobble together more information. But today, this morning, Peterson has hired an attorney, and that attorney has put out a rebuttal to Sheriff Israel's comments, saying that Deputy Peterson first heard that they were firecrackers near the 1200 building, that he rushed, and initially, when he heard the shots, believed that they were coming from outside, heard that there was somebody wounded on the football field, which seemed to confirm that information. Apparently, according to Peterson's attorney, he told a Coral Springs officer, who was the first to arrive, that he believed the shots were coming outside. That officer is set up by a tree. So he is pushing back on information that Peterson was sort of cowardly hiding next to the building, you know, freezing, not going in as kids died. I think there's still a lot of questions about exactly what happened, but that deputy is now disputing, that he is sort of the scapegoat of, or he's arguing that he's being a scapegoat for the department.
What do we know about the protocol when it comes to, you know, your resource officer or whatever deputies are on site? What are they supposed to do if they think there's a shooting? Enter the building, stay outside of the building? He said that they were trying to create a perimeter. I mean, what do we know about the protocol?
Well, according to the sheriff, that the protocol is clear that deputies, when there is an active shooter, are to immediately go to try and stop the shooter, to stop him from killing people. I've seen Politico Florida questioning what specifically is in the Broward Sheriff's Office a procedural manual about what exactly to do in that situation. But Jake Tapper on CNN did ask him about, whether there's, whether deputies have some kind of direction to try to go to checkpoints first and figure out where they're supposed to go, which was suggested after the airport shooting in January 2017. And Israel said that in a situation like the shooting at Stoneman Douglas, that the directive that everybody knows they're supposed to rush right in and try to stop this person from shooting.
Again, I'm talking with the Miami Herald reporter David Smiley, who's been covering the story of Sheriff Scott Israel in Broward County. Again, shortly after the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, it seemed like Sheriff Israel was the calm force that a lot of people were looking to. But now he is under attack, again, by lawmakers and critics that say that he didn't do enough. His deputies didn't do enough to protect the students. So let's talk about Scott Peterson. Again, this is the officer who he resigned. Could he face any sort of criminal charges?
I suppose it's possible, but I don't. It seems like that would be pretty unlikely. Maybe criminal negligence or something like that. But I would be surprised if anybody tried to bring charges against him. Maybe lawsuits, negligence lawsuits from the victim's families, that would seem possible, if not likely, but I'd be surprised if there were criminal charges.
And the other thing, too, is that the sheriff's office has been criticized for not following up on dozens of complaints and tips about the shooter. What do we know about that?
Well, we know that the sheriff's office released details of 23 service calls and or tips about the residences where Nicholas Cruz lived with his family, with his brother and their adopted mother. And on several of those calls, the Broward Sheriff's Office was informed that Cruz was, in one case, suicidal. He may have ingested gasoline, was something obsessed with weapons. In two cases, references were made to the belief that, he had either threatened to or might shoot up a school. In one of the last tips, someone called from out of state, from Massachusetts, and discussed that he may be a school shooter in the making. That call apparently was referred to the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office because Cruz was living in the Lake Worth area at the time. But one of the things that BSO is investigating right now is that apparently there was no report documented by BSO after that call. And we do know that that from the transcripts of the January 5th FBI tip about Cruz, which the FBI has acknowledged was not forwarded to the Miami field office and investigated the way it should have been, that caller was frustrated having contacted what I believe she referred to as Parkland Police, which would be the Broward Sheriff's Office, and the fact that she had gotten no follow-up from them either. So there's certainly a lot of questions about whether BSO should and could have done more to stop what happened.
All right, so now we know what lawmakers are saying about the sheriff, or some of them anyway, but what about the people in the community? What are they saying about the sheriff and all of this criticism?
I haven't heard a ton of reaction to the sheriff, but certainly some of the students who have been involved in the movement, the Never Again movement that has gotten so much steam, and some of the students who have gotten a lot of TV time, have either defended Israel and the Broward Sheriff's Office or really tried to, I think, stay away from going down that road. I certainly think there's a feeling that focusing on the sheriff's office and whether Peterson, didn't go in or whether the calls weren't handled properly, I think for students who are pushing the gun control movement, they feel like that's becoming a distraction, that to focus on that is to take away from what they see as an issue of a 19-year-old with a history of mental health problems who was able to purchase an AR-15 and go and shoot their school up. So there's been some criticism of BSO and of Scott Peterson, definitely. Certainly feelings of disgust voiced after Israel announced on Thursday that, he said Peterson never went into the building. I think in a lot of cases we've seen Parkland try to continue to shift the conversation and focus on gun control.
All right. So as you mentioned a little while ago that, this is the second time that the sheriff's office has been criticized for the way it's handled mass shootings, because the first one, of course, was the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport shooting. How does the criticism from that tragedy compare to what he's facing now?
I think the criticism of you're asking about comparing the airport shooting to what's happening now?
Yeah, and what, the reaction, again, people had to the way that the law enforcement dealt with it.
Well, I think the criticism of the response to the airport shooting was far less severe, and it was BSO's own internal reports that pointed out some of the flaws and problems in their response, and secondly, I don't think there were questions at the time about whether their response to the shooting, cost lives or could have saved more lives. They stopped that shooter pretty quickly in under a minute and a half. It was the response afterward, the flood of officers from different agencies coming in, that created mass confusion and shut down the airport for hours and led to people believing that there were maybe one or two more other shooters around the airport. So in that instance, it was just confusion after the fact. They had the shooter in custody very quickly, and then it was chaos. In this case, you have a lot of legitimate questions about whether the confusion or whether shortcomings in handling tips caused 17 people to die and 15 more to be wounded.
Again, David Smiley covering the story of Sheriff Scott Israel and a lot of the criticism that he's getting now, and even calls by some lawmakers for the governor to suspend him. He's been covering the story for the Miami Herald. David, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
All right, who's still to come? Who are school resource officers? What is their role when it comes to campus security? We're going to talk about that coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. And just remember that you can always find us online, WLRN.org, or on Facebook. Just look up WLRN Sundial. I'd love to hear your thoughts on anything that you've heard on the show today. Well, to find out more about the role of police officers in schools, we're going to talk now to Mac Hardy of the National Association of School Resource Officers. He's at the association's office in Hoover, Alabama. Mac Hardy, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. Mac Hardy, are you there?
Yes, Lewis. Thank you for having me.
All right. I appreciate that. You know, how is a school resource officer different from a regular police officer?
A school resource officer is a properly selected, properly trained, sworn police officer. And the training is specific to dealing in a triad approach, law enforcement. You also are a mentor, and you also are an educator.
All right. So what kind of training do you recommend officers have to prepare, you know, resource officers that have to prepare for an active shooter situation?
For an active shooter situation, that goes back, you know, also to the portion I said about being properly selected. But being trained, our training that we suggest, and which is you've heard from several others, I think, and listened to your last interview, is that we train direct threat. We can't wait. It's been proven over the years you can't wait. That if there's an officer inside the school, he needs to move directly to the threat to stop it, to try to neutralize it, so there's no further loss of life.
So they are expected to confront the shooter, even without backup?
Correct, yes. Now we're expected to communicate our movement to responding officers, and those response officers, as they respond, should move towards that officer to help stop that threat also.
Could you tell me a little bit about how this changed? Because I believe it did after Columbine.
Yes, it did change after Columbine. And to no fault of them, that, you know, they set up perimeters and you kind of called and you waited on responding officers, or maybe even sometimes it was mentioned you wait on SWAT team. But we know that this is an ongoing situation, that every minute and every second that passes, there's loss of life. So the decision to move direct threat to try to get the person that had the means and had the ability to stop that situation from continuing, that's how it transformed and changed.
Do you have members serving in schools which have been attacked by active shooters?
We do have members that have been in schools where there have been shootings, and they have responded well.
I mean, could you give me an example to get an idea, again, of who these resource officers are and how they are trained to handle this?
I'm sorry, I do not have those in front of me, but I'm sure that if, you know, these things can be found on the Internet and so forth, but I do not have those situations directly in front of me.
Okay. Do you recommend any kind of therapeutic measures for officers who've experienced something like this? I mean, what kind of assistance do they get afterwards?
Well, I think the police, you know, departments deal with situations after a shooting or after dealing with a situation in the schools or on the streets. They have resources through their department for counseling to deal with these emotions that are involved in this, and believe me, when an officer's in the school and he's working with these kids and this staff every day, that it is, you know, we try to approach our work in a business-like manner, but it is personal, because these officers that work in these schools love these kids and love these staff members as a teacher, as an administrator does.
Again, I'm talking with Matt Hardy. He's of the National Association of School Resource Officers, and he's at the association's office in Hoover, Alabama. Earlier, Mac, you talked about it's got to be the right person for the job. Tell me a little bit about who that right person is. How do you find them?
Well, I think that when you're in your department, we think about a police officer that has experience, maybe not the person that is just hired, newly hired, but a police officer that has experience, a police officer that really loves kids, that wants to be involved, that has an outgoing personality, that's easily approachable, because we want to bridge the gap between law enforcement and the youth. We want to be approachable. Sometimes we feel law enforcement officers are not approachable, but a resource officer needs to be approachable. Kids come and talk to, community members come and talk to, really enjoys that interaction.
Are these people who are former law enforcement, former military, or does it matter?
Well, our definition of a law or of a SRO is a sworn police officer. It is an active police officer. Now, we do. There are communities that have SSOs, school security officers, and that might be a officer that they hired that may not have arrest powers, but is helping to protect the school.
But they are members of police departments, though, right? I mean, the one in Broward was.
Right. Well, you know, like I said, an SRO is a sworn police officer.
Okay.
They may be on the SWAT team. They may have come over from investigations or from a patrol division, but they are a police officer.
And so is this a uniformed officer on campus, or how do they approach? Because you talk about, you know, that they have to bridge that gap between law enforcement and students. They want to build a trust. Are they in uniform, or is it, you know, they just walking around the campus, again, trying to have those interactions with people?
Well, the uniform issue is from a departmental decision, is a departmental decision. Some departments choose to have officers in a polo-style shirt, but they should be properly equipped to handle an emergency situation. With that being said, then they should have all their duty equipment that is assigned to them so they can follow SOP, their rules of engagement. Some departments are fully uniformed police officers. I came from a department that the officers that worked in the schools were fully uniformed, and I never had a problem with students approach me, because, like I've always said, it's not the uniform that deters kids from talking to you. It's the person inside of the uniform.
How many SROs are assigned to schools?
Well, we don't have an exact number, but we believe that about 20% of schools in the United States have an SRO.
All right. Does that include charter schools or just public schools?
I would dare to say that was, you know, public schools in the United States.
Is there a minimum amount of SROs that a school needs to have at all times?
Well, we just got back from a board meeting, and that was one of the discussions from our board and our representatives to that board. And, you know, there's a lot to be determined there. You know, sometimes it said 1 to 1,000 students. That ratio you hear quite often, but there's a lot of other things. The size of your campus, the size of, if it's a single building, but it's a three-story building, and these schools that they're building nowadays are just so large that one officer may not be enough. So it's a case-by-case situation that you look at the number of students inside the school, the size of the buildings, the size of the campus.
What about guidelines for how these officers are supposed to handle tips? If you get tips about a student who is behaving, or I should say acting violently, or has exhibited disturbing behavior, how are they trained to handle tips?
Well, one thing that we always teach is that a law enforcement officer cannot do this alone. Schools can't do it alone. But with a cooperation, a teamwork between schools, the law enforcement officers, SROs, and the community, then handling these tips, receiving these tips, become much more fluid. If the school receives a tip from the community or from another student, then there should be guidelines on how to handle it. Do they have threat assessments that they can move into where a team, not just an administrator, not just the SRO or a teacher, but a team of individuals from your school, including mental health workers, social workers, law enforcement, administrators, they all look at the situation and they reach out to the community, they reach out to parents to get the full picture of what's going on in this child's life. And that is to protect other kids, but it is also to help protect the child who is in distress.
So we've heard this argument before, but after this shooting, we've heard the president talk about arm the teachers. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, our statement that that we put out is that we believe that every school in America should have a school resource officer. And that being said, is a properly trained and a properly selected police officer. Before I was a police officer, I was a teacher in a middle school. And my role, I went to that school every day as a teacher to teach children. As a resource officer, every day I put on that uniform, I knew I was going to that school to protect the kids I love, to protect the kids in the community that I lived in, and that was my role and that was my duty.
Do you think that SROs should be more heavily armed? Considering, again, that you look at these mass shootings, and one thing in common is the shooter is carrying a lot of weapons, more than one, and the AR-15 tends to be a very popular weapon.
Well, the belt that they carry plenty of ability to stop the situation. But in many cases, SROs are are provided, you know, the same tools that the street officers are provided. Now, where they store those is up to that department and up to that school system. And a lot of these decisions are made by creating an MOU, a memorandum of understanding between the school district and the police department. Some officers keep their long guns, their patrol rifles, inside the school in a lock safe, connected, secured fastly, fastened to the walls of their office or wherever it may be. Sometimes they keep it locked in a locked compartment inside of their vehicles on the school grounds. But a lot of officers are provided with a weapon, a long gun, a patrol rifle, whatever it may be. Along with, not only that, the ability of everything else that they carry on their duty belt. And that goes, say, not only with weapons that, you know, to encounter deadly force, but also less lethal weapons, tasers, pepper spray, maybe a shotgun that shoots the bean bags, and so forth.
Again, Mac Hardy is of the National Association of School Resource Officers, joining us at the association's office in Hoover, Alabama. Mac Hardy, appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's the program for today. I wanted to end things on a little bit of a high note. Speaking of Stoneman Douglas High School, their hockey team, seeded fourth in the state tournament this weekend, won the Florida championship by beating Tampa Jesuit 7-4 in the finals on Sunday. Player Ronnie Frischel spoke with WSBN 7 News.
We almost didn't even come here because we didn't know if we wanted to play or not. I'm glad we did it. I'm glad we came. I'm just happy to be alive, and I play for those who can't.
And, you know, one of the amazing things about this is that each of the players received a championship medal to wear. 17 players. There were 17 victims of the shooting. When the players returned to the campus, each of them placed their medal on one of the crosses at the makeshift memorial. Congratulations to the school, by the way, because considering everything that they've been through, just good to end on a high note and have something positive to talk about. Congratulations to the players, the coaches, and, of course, the families and the school. Again, the students will be returning to class on Wednesday. It's a half day, and then they get back to, I guess, normalcy by Thursday. That's our program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.